Ferguson, 5 years later. This is a Special Takeaway podcast. I'm Tanzina Vega. We'll hear from a woman who says the events in Ferguson made her an activist.
You see so much progression. You see so many people working to really make change. But at the same time, you see this city stay the same.
The cop who was brought in to bring peace to a community in pain.
Both wanted to pull me to the side. And for me, it was about walking that middle of the road and bringing the two groups together. And so some people saw me as a traitor.
And the journalist who covered it all.
It just really was this moment where you could feel kind of the country tearing itself apart at its seams.
But at the same time, I was welcomed by people who, once you told them what you were trying to do, they were willing to speak.
And we start now. It's been 5 years since Michael Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. Within days, Ferguson was flooded with reporters from all across the world, including me. At the time, I was part of a New York Times team that was dispatched to the scene. I'll never forget driving onto West Florissant Avenue, where protesters gathered day and night, and seeing armored trucks, law enforcement dressed in fatigues and battle gear, and being pelted with tear gas. I can't forget the image of people running through the thick clouds of smoke, knocking on the door of the McDonald's, and trying to get something, anything, to pour in their eyes just to calm the sting of the tear gas. Wesley Lowery of the Washington Post was there too, but he stayed much longer, spending 4 months on and off in Ferguson, covering what quickly became a national conversation on race and police brutality. And Wesley's with me now to talk about what he experienced and the role of media in shaping the aftermath of Brown's death. He's a national correspondent for the Washington Post. Wesley, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Aaron Morrison, a senior reporter for The Appeal, who spent time in Ferguson 6 months later. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
I remember the first time I saw anything about Michael Brown was on Twitter, and it was the photo of his body on Canefield Drive. Wesley, what was your first memory? When did you first hear about Michael Brown? And from that point to being on the ground in Ferguson, tell us what happened there.
Sure. And so it certainly was that first day, August 9th, the photo of Michael Brown's body on the ground, many of the tweets from St. Louis, from Ferguson that day. At the time, I was in Michigan. I was covering a congressional race in suburban Detroit, but I was following the local coverage. And by the time I got back to D.C. that following Monday, there had now been two or three nights of protest, of anger, still very few answered questions. And by that evening, I was on a plane to Ferguson, got there Monday evening, August 11th.
Aaron, you were a reporter in New Jersey at the time. Mm-hmm. When did you hear about Michael Brown's death, and what was the reaction where you were in communities outside of Ferguson in New Jersey?
The same way that most people learned about it, I saw it on social media, and I was at a paper covering hyper-local news. And so I found a way to localize the story. Okay, what's happened here recently that people, you know, might be interested in revisiting as we're starting to have a new conversation about police brutality in this country?
I got to Ferguson, Wesley, probably about a week after you were there, and I was there for 8 days, so I don't want to make this some sort of martyr thing that I did, but I was sent out, the New York Times, part of a larger New York Times team, and the first things I recall are the heat, driving right to a police press conference where you and other folks were there, and this sort of lingering tension in the air. When you finally got to Ferguson, what were your feelings? What did you remember?
You got to imagine, and those of us who've been there know, right? Canfield Drive is a set of apartment buildings that's kind of down a side street. Michael Brown had been killed in the middle of the street, his body laid out there for hours. And so you had hundreds of people who were looking out their window of their home and seeing the body of a teenager. And no one was answering any questions for them. And meanwhile, every single night, there were hundreds of people showing up in protest. And so every night, you had the standoff between the citizens and the police. And more nights than not, it ended in chaos.
Aaron, when you got to Ferguson, when did you get there? And what were your first scenes? Like, what was this feeling like on the ground?
So I went to Ferguson roughly 6 months after the first uprising. And what I found, things hadn't been completely covered up. The quick trip was still fenced off and it was still burned. There were still signs of what had happened, what I'd only seen, you know, from far away.
Wesley, How were you received by the police and law enforcement more broadly? And what was your relationship like with protesters?
So I think that there was certainly among the police a frustration with the media. I think that a lot of the powers that be in Greater St. Louis, not just the police, but a lot of the political establishment, some of the statewide elected officials, thought that the media and the national media were somehow the problem. The news is missing it. Nothing is true. This is all wrong. It's all made up, right? Now, that is obviously wasn't the case, right? That the national media came in and told a bunch of stories of local residents that had not been being told otherwise. And ultimately, the Department of Justice concluded that these complaints of the demonstrators and the protesters were true. They were correct, that the police were systemically abusing people here in Ferguson and St. Louis County. But the relationship with the police was extremely tense. And frankly, it's supposed to be that way to some extent, right? We're trying to get answers from our government. But that said, on many nights of the protests, there were clear and obvious kind of First Amendment violations, right? Journalists being arrested for trying to do their jobs, being threatened, well, if you don't move this way, we're going to shoot tear gas at you. There was video footage of police officers disassembling camera equipment or moving aggressively at members of the media. The protesters also kind of had mixed feelings about the media. And understandable, right? Here we had all come and shown up in this place, and they were frustrated. Sometimes they thought the media coverage wasn't fair. They thought their quotes were being chopped and screwed and not used in fair ways. Or they thought we were missing the bigger story. And so there were definitely moments of real tension. I think all of us who spent a lot of time there had people who welcomed us with open arms and other people who were like, you guys should get out of here.
And Aaron, when you got there 6 months after, was there a different feeling about you being a member of the press? Were the police more open? Were residents more open? Or was there wariness?
I saw both of those things. I saw people who were tired of the dozens of news trucks being parked everywhere. But at the same time, I was welcomed by people who, once you told them what you were trying to do, what you were trying to uncover, or what you were trying to amplify, they were willing to speak. They were willing to speak because they wanted to show multiple sides to their community. Everyone had seen the unrest, but few people had seen Ferguson when it experienced some calm. And so that's what I was able to show as people prepared for the election, as people were going around and canvassing neighborhoods to get, you know, votes for the city council. I visited a school where students and teachers were having conversations about what had taken place in their city. There was a confirmation, I think, that what had been reported by folks that were there early on really was what it was. Like it there was not some, you know, conspiracy by the media to make this fake news moment, which I was refreshing, because I was like, okay, now I'm going to build on what my peers have already done here.
You're both Black male reporters. Did you feel that folks in Ferguson were more likely to speak to you?
Yes, unquestionably. I thought that it wasn't even just being a Black reporter, it was also being a young Black reporter, that many of the people in the streets were young people, were teenagers, were college-age students. Many of the young activists were in their early 20s, and I was a young Black reporter in my early 20s. I think that one of the things we know about being journalists, about being reporters, is that it's our job to talk to people and convince people to tell us things. And it's about building relationships. And each one of us are who we are as a person. Our backgrounds, our family trees and social connections help us build relationships. There are some doors that I might knock on that I'll get them slammed in my face while another colleague will get it opened, and vice versa. And so as it became increasingly important that these stories of Black Americans, many of them poor or low income, who had felt like they'd been abused by the police and abused by the government, as that became one of the chief domestic storylines in the country, it was extremely important that newsrooms employed people who could engender the trust of the folks closest to those stories. And more often than not, that was reporters who looked like the three of us.
Right. And I could add to that. I experienced going to a church, a Black church, where the pastor told me up front, like, I've turned down so many reporters. But the moment I told him that my family was also in the Church of God in Christ, he gave me access immediately to members of his congregation who did still, you know, want to speak about their experience, and not just their experience during the uprising, but their experience since the 80s and the 70s in this community, where this used to be a majority white community that flipped and became a majority Black community, but the city government never became majority Black. And so there were all sorts of implications for police. So that was my way in, was embracing family history and identity to gain access and be able to tell a thorough story.
Wesley, just to wrap up, have we, as the media, gotten better at covering this topic and topics related to the killing of Black and brown Americans by police?
Yes and no. To the extent to which this topic is covering police-involved shootings specifically, I think the answer is yes. I think that these cases showed why it's important for us to be skeptical of power and skeptical of government and not just believe everything the police says. But to the extent to which this issue is race in America, I think the ongoing coverage of the current president, of his campaign, of his rhetoric, shows the extent to which the media is still not completely equipped and completely ready to tell these stories. And a big part of that is because we all love our colleagues, we love our newsrooms, but we know that our newsrooms still do not represent the diversity and the complexity of the country that we cover. That the vast majority of people writing these stories, assigning these stories, editing the audio, directing the coverage are middle-class white people. And because of that, our media collectively has a deep blind spot as it relates to issues of race, and very often does not have the proper skepticism or the proper perspective on how issues of power, issues of disparity, and issues of injustice work. And so there's still a long way to go, but I'm really glad to have colleagues like you and Aaron, who I know are working hard on this type of stuff too.
And we'll end on that note. Wesley Lowery is the national correspondent for The Washington Post, and Aaron Morrison is senior reporter for The Appeal. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace!
The events in Ferguson inspired a new generation of activists in the area, including Ahun Ashe, founder of For the Culture STL, a network of Black-owned businesses in the St. Louis area. Ahun, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
It was 5 years ago that Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. How did you first learn of his death?
Well, I grew up in Jennings, Missouri, which is right next door to Ferguson. And I was actually at my mom's house visiting her when I saw on Twitter the picture where Michael Brown's stepfather was holding that said, "Ferguson Police Department just killed my 17-year-old son." And from there, the first night, I watched on Twitter as everything just unraveled and was just exposed, because I couldn't believe this was happening so close on the street that I walked almost every day growing up.
So from that moment, I think a lot of us remember that, seeing those tweets and seeing the image of Michael Brown, his body laying on Canefield Drive. From that moment, the protests began almost immediately. When did you start getting involved with those protests?
The first night where the rioting occurred, I was so mad at the community, because that, like I said, that was the street that I grew up on. That Quick Trip was where I got my gas almost every day. So the first night I went out with my sorority to clean up West Florissant. So as we were passing by the Quick Trip, there was a group of people gathering. It was community. It was people talking about what had just taken place, trying to get understanding, figuring out next steps. And I remember, like, just taking it all in and then hearing the sirens from so many police cars. And I was confused, because I was like, I haven't seen anything happen. I haven't heard anything. So where are all these police cars going? Literally about 20 police cars pulled up to the Quick Trip, put on riot gear, had their batons, and was antagonizing the crowd, pushing them into the street. But if you were anybody watching from home and on any mainstream news, what you saw playing was the recurring footage from the looting and the fires from the night before. So the truth wasn't out there. And my background is videography and journalism. So I felt like it was so important to record what was going on and put it on social media. So from there, I decided to come out every single night that I could to show people what was really going on.
You mentioned the police putting on, you know, riot gear, et cetera. Let's talk a little bit more about the police, because one of the things that struck me about the protests when I was there was seeing how heavily militarized the police presence was. At one point, there were even U.S. National Guard there. There were tanks and people wearing fatigues, at least law enforcement wearing fatigues. Like, how has that relationship between law enforcement and the community evolved since Ferguson?
The thing about it is that it hasn't evolved. Law enforcement is still systematically racist. They are still abusing the African American community. When we had our Jason Stockley protest in 2017, they were even worse than what they were in Ferguson. In Ferguson, we did have a lot of tear gas and things like that. But in 2017, we saw a lot of kettling, which is when police are surrounding people in protest and mass arresting everyone. We saw them abusing protesters that would arrest people and tear gas us. So the law enforcement here in St. Louis is the exact same that they were back in 2014.
Ahun, the protests have had a ripple effect beyond Ferguson and even St. Louis. And they were a flashpoint in the Black Lives Matter movement. And even though that has begun focusing more on strategic policy change, I'm wondering, have you noticed a change in terms of local politics or people running for city or state seats in Missouri?
We have had a lot of progression in Black folks getting involved in politics. A year ago, we got Wesley Bell into office as a prosecuting attorney, which originally was the position of Bob McCullough, who was the prosecuting attorney for the Mike Brown case. We also have Kim Gardner in office that is the prosecuting attorney in the city. And both of these people have worked diligently to change and shift politics in St. Louis County and city. We have a protest member who is now even sitting on the council board for Ferguson itself. So when we talk about change, we have a lot more people getting involved that are doing big things in policy and politic changes. I mean, progressing us more than ever before.
Ahun, you also work with the small business community in Ferguson. And one of the things I recall seeing on West Florissant Avenue, you mentioned the Quick Trip and getting gas from there. And a lot of those businesses were boarded up for quite some time. How are the businesses doing in the community today, especially Black-owned businesses?
What August 9, 2014 did for a lot of Black folks was knowing that we had to now take care of ourselves. So we have a lot more Black businesses in our communities, but we don't just have them in the traditional storefront. You see Black businesses that are successful off of social media, off of websites like Etsy. We have mobile boutiques and mobile barbershops. So what you see is this surge of Black businesses, which is where I started for theculturestl.com, was to support and bring light to the businesses that are coming into our community and that are for our community.
There have been a number of Ferguson activists who've died since these events. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you think about that or feel about that?
So reflecting on the 5 years, you think about the people. I'm sorry. You think about the people that you started this journey with. And how many of them aren't with you anymore? We had Darren Sales, who was a really dear friend of mine, who lost his life. He was shot and burned in his car. And the police completely handled the crime scene. They left real evidence there. They left the car door. They left bullet shells for people to touch on. So in ways, you see so much progression. You see so many people working to really make change. But at the same time, you see this city stay the same. You see the system itself work very hard to keep
marginalized people marginalized, to keep systematic oppression real. And they do this by showcasing us the most brutal ways that how they will mistreat us, how that if things happen to us, they won't take care of it properly. And we have lost some real soldiers, some real people who were for the community, who would protest, who would put things together. And it hurts. It hurts to reflect and see how far so many people are in protesting, in moving the system forward. But then it's so many of them that didn't make it also.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I know this is a difficult conversation to have. Do you feel, based on what we just talked about, do you think that Ferguson got a lot of attention 5 years ago? Protests were ongoing. All the media was there. But do you think it did more for the country and its awareness to police brutality, particularly directed at Black Americans, than it actually did for the St. Louis region?
I feel like it did exactly what it was supposed to do. When Ferguson happened, it opened up police brutality in St. Louis, in the world, across the America. We started learning people's names that had been taken by police brutality. We started paying attention. We started remembering the number of people who lost their lives. So we had a lot of attention here in St. Louis. And we know in the climate that we in, trends come and go. So the cameras may have left St. Louis, but the work never left St. Louis. The people doing the work never left St. Louis. So it benefited us and it benefited the world, like nationally, because now we have to pay attention. Now people are coming together to create change. It's 5 years later and this issue is still being talked about. It's still being worked on. It's still people that have dedicated their lives to breaking down systems in policing, racism, all of these things. So it was something for not just St. Louis. Michael Brown losing his life literally changed the world. We also have to take into account that we aren't wanting just like policy changes, because policy changes aren't enough. We need cultural changes. So we need the police forces to want to really be different. And anything that we know about culture is that it takes a lot of time. We oftentimes want to see progression right away. And I would love it if that would be the way that things worked, but it's not. So we have to allow those little wins that we have to be really big wins for us. We have to also practice patience in getting to the cultural change and cultural shift that we have to have in America to make this sustain itself.
Ahun Ashe is an activist and founder of For the Culture STL, a network of Black-owned businesses in the St. Louis region. Ahun, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Five days after Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, police clashed with protesters in a display of force that sparked other protests around the nation. As the police response escalated, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon put State Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson in charge of police operations in the embattled city for the weeks and months that followed. Here's a clip of a conversation I witnessed between Johnson and a protester.
Stay with us at night. Don't leave us. Don't leave us, man. Stay with us at night.
I am getting 3 to 4 hours of sleep.
Me too. And I don't get paid. Listen.
I work for $1,000. I get paid 8 hours. After 8 hours, I am out here for free. And I'm going to tell you, do you know what I don't want to do and I'm not going to do? I'm not going to get sick where you wake up in the morning and say, where's Ron Johnson?
Johnson has since retired and has written a book about his experiences in Ferguson. And he joins us via Skype to discuss the protests and their impact 5 years later. Captain Johnson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So when you listen back to that clip, and there are so many other moments, tensions were high and your job was to calm the situation, but there had been escalating conflict and protesters for days. The National Guard was posted right up the hill from where that interaction took place. What was that like for you personally?
Well, being a part of the community and growing up there and having walked those streets, it was tough to see. There was a feeling of duty as a policeman, but also a feeling of pain as a citizen of that community. So those days were tough personally and professionally.
There was another element that came into play, which was Officer Darren Wilson. And I'm going to play another clip from the interaction that we heard earlier, actually, where you're addressing this person who's asking you about Darren Wilson specifically.
I can tell you, I was not involved in that investigation. My job here is protect you, protect the livelihood of this community. I'm going to tell you.
The issue is not to discipline us, it's to help us. Listen, we the citizens. Listen, we paying this man paid vacation. That hurts us. These kids are angry, okay, and they being hit with things, and they are getting destructive. And we asking for your help. The adults are asking for your help.
Captain Johnson, clearly a very tense moment. How do you weigh your job and so at the time and trying to ease tensions between the community and police while at the same time dealing with that level of frustration, dealing with that level of fear, and really, you know, having tear gas and tanks in the background?
For me, it was to try to bring peace for the moment and bring a time where we could have a discussion. I did understand the frustration, but my job there was to ensure that protesters had their rights, freedom of speech, but also to protect them and to protect those law enforcement officers that were out there preserving that right. And so it becomes tough.
Captain, there was a 2015 U.S. Justice Department report on the events in Ferguson, and it said that many of those civilians that you spoke to said that you actually had a positive impact on their relations with law enforcement. But there were some officers who were interviewed who said that they thought your efforts were detrimental because you appeared to support the demonstrators. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, people saw me in two different lights. The policeman saw me as this policeman wearing the blue uniform that they wore. People of color saw me as an African-American, and both wanted to pull me to the side. And for me, it was about walking that middle of the road and bringing the two groups together. And said some people saw me as a traitor because I wouldn't take a side.
You mean law enforcement and or the black community saw you as a traitor?
Yes, because people wanted me to take your side. And it wasn't about what side had the stronger point for me. It was about bringing peace and a conversation of inclusion that we must have to become better.
And as a result of that, I mean, being a black police officer in that environment, did you feel like there was extra scrutiny on your actions because of that?
Well, I know there was. But at that moment, it didn't really matter to me. I didn't think about that daily. I'm a man first, and all those other things come behind that. You know, I've been African-American and second, and then I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a friend, but I'm a lot of things. And so being a policeman was actually down on the ladder for me because I'm a lot of things before I put that uniform on. And so I just stood out there as a man, and I wanted people to see me as this man and not based on the color of my skin or the title that I had.
It's been 5 years since Michael Brown's death. What, in your opinion, has or hasn't changed in Ferguson since then?
I have seen some growth in Ferguson. We're planning on putting sidewalks along West Florissant, which sounds so simple, but the citizens talked about the safety of just walking down the street. Some people would say some things have gotten better, but some people would say that things are still the same, that after 5 years, they would have thought we would have been further.
And to that point, I wonder, as we look back and look to today in terms of police accountability, just in Ferguson, but also beyond. I mean, I'm talking to you from New York City, where Eric Garner was killed just days before Michael Brown. We're waiting to see whether or not the officer who was involved in that killing will actually be fired from his position. Captain, in your experience, given everything that we've just said, have police departments evolved in light of these events?
I think in some aspects, policing has gotten better. But I think it depends on who you ask. You know, if we would base things off of what's happened in El Paso and Ohio and, you know, the courage and heroic efforts of those law enforcement officers there, if we could be judged by that every day, our relationship would be outstanding. But I think relationships aren't based on heroics. They're based on what we do each and every day. And we have to continue to connect in ways that include all and hear the voice and not tell people what they need, but ask them what they want from us.
Captain, is there a moment, I'm sure there were many moments, but is there anything in particular that has stuck with you throughout these 5 years?
I think I always look back to the time when I was face-to-face with Michael Brown Jr.'s mom and dad. And that is a moment that I will never forget. And so it sticks with me that no matter what anyone thinks of that day on August 9th, no parent should ever suffer that kind of pain.
And is there anything that you would have done differently if you could go back?
I would have told those two that I was sorry a lot sooner than I did. And I think that that was a failure on law enforcement in this community. I think that should have been done a lot sooner.
I've been speaking with former Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson about his reflections on the 2014 protests in Ferguson. Captain Johnson has also written a book about his time running police operations there, and that's called 13 Days in Ferguson. Captain Johnson, thank you for taking the time and for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. It was an honor.
Thank you for listening to our coverage of Ferguson 5 years later. Big thanks to producers Josh Christensen, Danny Lewis, Isabel Angel, and Alexandra Boti for their work on this, along with web producers Polly Arungu and Meg Dalton. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer, with an assist from engineer Claire McKean. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.